Hello and welcome back to another podcast episode of the world's greatest podcast, which just so happens to be my podcast. Today we will be talking about gut health and all things gut health. If you don't know who I am, my name is Anna. I'm a personal trainer and an online coach, and I have my own fitness and wellness app. And today we have Dr. Pranav. Would you like to introduce yourselves to ourselves and tell us a little bit more about what you do?
Well, thank you, Anna, for inviting me here. It's fantastic. I'm a gastroenterologist. I'm Dr. Pranav. I'm a UK qualified consultant who has been in Dubai for approximately 18 months. My area of interest is functional GI disease, inflammatory bowel disease, and nutrition. I've taken a particular interest in gut microbiome, particularly because we have access to a lab which has within it access to shotgun metagenomic sequencing, which you won't know anything about at the moment, but I can tell you it is the most advanced DNA sequencing technology available for gut microbiome. So I utilize that in my daily practice when I see patients with a variety of different conditions and relate that a lot to the GI tract and to the diet and to how you improve it by understanding the gut microbiome.
So speaking of gut microbiome, could you explain what gut microbiome is? I know it's a very broad subject and very complicated, but in simple terms, what is it? How do we define it?
Sure. Well, the gut microbiome, most people understand it's the bacteria inside the bowels, but actually the gut microbiome consists of not just bacteria. It consists of the viruses, the fungi, and 1,000 different species that live within the intestine. It weighs almost 1 kilogram to 2 kilograms in individuals. So most people don't realize just how much bugs they have within them. Now, and there's a continuous balancing act between the good and the bad, which we can talk about. But the outcome of that balancing act is some of the products that these bugs within you produce, which we're now understanding has a profound effect on your digestive system, your immune system, how your brain functions, how your heart works, how it affects your liver. Profound, because you produce all these ingredients, powerful antioxidants, powerful metabolites that get into your system, help you digest sugar, fat, all of these things which we didn't know before, but now we're understanding far more. So that's the relevance of the gut microbiome. With the technology, we are understanding what it consists of, what it produces, and slowly understanding that changing that or having a positive effect on it can really help your health.
So I have asked my audience on Instagram and I have asked my clients to ask me, to ask you some questions. And one of the most common questions was about bloating. What causes bloating? What can we do to improve bloating? Is it normal? Is it not?
Bloating is a very common phenomenon. And what I see within my clinic setting, I go through a few things that you have to make sure the patient doesn't have. The most common cause I find of patients having bloating is relevant to the foods that they eat. Directly, the foods, when it's digested, produce gas, so that itself causes bloating. And then there's an effect on the food by the gut microbiome. What type of constituent is your gut microbiome? How does it digest the food? Does it produce more gas in some individuals? Yes, and in others, not. So that's one element. There's the other group where there's a sensitivity in the GI tract, function called irritable bowel syndrome, where there's extra bloating feeling because you're much more hypersensitive they're more hypersensitive with the nerves in the GI tract. Then there's other group of patients where there's slowing down of the bowel function, constipation, which lends itself to more bloating. So that's a combination of different types of patients that you might experience bloating with. But like I said, the most common thing is the type of food you have.
What would you say? Because I have most of my clients are females, yeah. And most of them struggle with either constipation or bloating, and I have struggled with this myself in the past, what would be the first step? Like, what would you say to someone if it was me, let's take me for an example, don't have a regular bowel movement, if I'm always bloated and constipated, or maybe go to the toilet once per week, what advice would you give me? Where should I start?
I think understanding, making sure first, if it is that change in bowel habit, has it been long-standing? If there's a change in bowel habit, we need to understand first there isn't an underlying reason for the change in bowel habits, because there are other causes of quite profound constipation. For instance, medicines that people might be taking, over-the-counter medicines, for instance, some disturbances in your salts, in your bloodstream, that can have an effect on your bowel function. Then there are other conditions which are more serious, which need to be excluded. And if they are excluded, then I generally say that provided you're opening your bowels at least once a day or once in 2 days, then you need to be going regularly to make sure that there is no buildup of stool within you, which lends itself to more gas fermentation and more gas production. So if you're making sure yourself opening your bowels regularly, that in itself is a very, very good help. Now, provided we get over that and make sure that's happening, then we have to look at the diet very carefully. And the way I approach it when it's a particular problem is through an elimination diet, where you go through and eliminate those items in the diet that might be causing particular gas production in themselves, or then look at how you manipulate the gut microbiome to try and make sure they don't contribute to more gas formation. So it's a combination of that. Clearly, other things that I tell patients besides that is they've got to keep moving. Good exercise keeps their bowels also regular in a good exercise mode. Making sure you're hydrated. There's no point taking a lot of fiber and soluble fiber if you're not drinking enough. And finally, stress. Stress has an enormous impact on the gut, and people do not realize just how much it influences. For instance, it might slow things down in some people. In others, it speeds things up. Exam nerves. A lot of people experience exam nerves, and that's the speeding up of your gut. The opposite can also happen. So you have to look at each of these elements and look at what that person in front of you is needs adjusting. And that, I think, combination of working through all of that usually helps patients when I see them.
And that's very good. What about prebiotics and probiotics? Would you recommend taking them as a supplement? Do we get enough of them through food? I eat a lot of pineapple, a lot of asparagus, a lot of fermented foods all the time. It's been like this since day one. So luckily right now I don't have any issues, but I don't take any pre or probiotics. Is this something that you would recommend people to take or not to take?
There's an enormous amount of interest in it. And in within at least the Dubai market, can you believe it? There's 70 different probiotics available. Now, that's a huge number, and there's no chance for me to go through each one to understand it. Has been very difficult, but it has been a journey, and I've tried to identify some which are good and which have got the evidence behind it. For instance, they contain certain bacteria species that have been shown in studies to be really good, for instance, in bloating or in fatty liver or in, for instance, patients with diabetes. So putting that aside, those are actual like either sachets or tablets, forms that people can buy. I generally try and pursue first the dietary, the natural way of increasing your prebiotics and probiotics. And don't forget, now we have a term called postbiotics. Postbiotics, for those who of your audience don't understand, is actually the metabolites that these bacteria produce. That's what is constitutes postbiotics, and very powerful stuff that bacteria produce is what postbiotics is, and it's going to be another field that's going to grow, and people are going to start hearing about postbiotics. But essentially, if you have good prebiotics and good probiotics into your diet, the postbiotics should be produced by the bacteria that you're feeding and you're taking in, so you have less worries about that. Now, in terms of prebiotics and postbiotics, I think what you've mentioned about the fruits that you have, the vegetables, if people take a different colored vegetable every day, or fruit, for instance, an apple one day, an orange another day, green vegetables the next day, that in itself means that you're getting a good deal of prebiotics into your system, because a lot of these plant-based foods have got fiber, the right constituent of fiber, which then feed through the beneficial bacteria in your gut. So the prebiotics basically means the food ingredients that you need to give the bacteria to grow, to thrive. There's no point giving yourself lots of probiotics if you don't feed those bacteria, which is contained in the probiotics, with really nourishing stuff. Otherwise, the probiotics go in and the bacteria will not survive without the food, without their beneficial prebiotic food. So you have to have a combination. And your combination, which you mentioned very briefly, is the pineapples, the fruits that you have, along with the fermented food, because generally probiotic-rich food are fermented food. And you mentioned yogurt. There are other things. Some people like sauerkraut. Others like who like Japanese foods like miso, natto. Now, all of these constitute really rich probiotic food. Yep, taking that regularly is a very good idea, along with your fiber-rich food. And a combination of that does wonders. So to make yourself really develop your gut microbiome and really nourish it, you have to take your prebiotics and you need to mix it in with some fermented food.
I really wanted to ask you one of the questions was also about food intolerances.
Yeah.
What causes food intolerance? How do we know if we have a food intolerance? Are there any tests that you would recommend people to take? How do we know?
Now, within gastroenterology, food intolerances can come in various shapes and sizes. But the things we do check for instance, where we actually do a blood test, is gluten sensitivity in patients who have actually got a gluten sensitivity. And that's fairly common, more common than people realize. And this is where if you take gluten, which is contained in a lot of wheat products, bread and things like that, it really induces an inflammatory reaction inside your intestine. And that's what you're looking for in the blood test. So besides that, where there's actual physical damage being caused by gluten going into the diet, a lot of people still have an intolerance, which is where they don't feel they cope with certain foods, really irritate them, really cause them bloating or feel discomfort in their tummy. And that is a reaction that the body is having in those patients where it's not really enjoying that particular food. The digestive system is disturbing it in some ways, but where we can't identify actual physical disturbance that it's causing any damage. It doesn't cause damage, but it causes irritation. Now, how do you identify that? I certainly do not advocate the skin prick test for that. That has a different role, where you're doing skin prick tests to find an allergic reaction, and that's a special test you would do with, if you felt you were allergic to certain foods, where it induces a reaction to you. So that itself doesn't help us identify foods that are an intolerance, where you don't feel well with it. The best approach I've found in my patients, where they say there's an intolerance and they have quite considerable discomfort, abdominal pain or bloating particularly, and we've looked at all other causes and ruled out anything else that might be causing it, is elimination diet through using low FODMAPs first, because FODMAPs are particular food ingredients which actually have a tendency to produce more gas within the bowels. And what we do is we eliminate all of those ingredients and then gradually reintroduce that into the diet. And then we can identify which particular one is the culprit amongst, for instance, the top ones are usually wheat products or dairy products, egg products, and some sugar, certain fruit sugars. These are the ones that are most common. And so you go through a proper controlled, regulated diet where you have eliminated the topmost common causes of bloating, producing foods, you'll feel great during that time, but it's very restrictive. So you have to, again, reintroduce certain foods, and one by one, you introduce it back into your system. And I found patients really identify the culprit utilizing that method. And then once you eliminate that, then they're much more able to cope with the other ingredients. It won't eliminate bloating, but it'll reduce it far, far more.
I have one selfish question.
Yeah.
So when I was getting ready for my competition a few years ago, I was in a calorie deficit for 6 months, 5-6 months, and I made a mistake. I know now, I didn't know then. When I was eating the exact same four meals every single day for those 5-6 months, and I would always have oatmeal for breakfast, and then I would always have like a big tuna salad with two boiled eggs in the evening for dinner. So by the end of, after those 5 months, I could not digest oats anymore, and I could not digest boiled eggs anymore. So I would get so bloated and just feel very uncomfortable. What advice would you give to me or someone who might be experiencing something like this? Because I get a lot of questions and a lot of messages online from people saying, oh, oats make me really bloated, but I still eat them. So I always say, try the elimination diet, maybe take them out of your diet for a little while and then slowly reintroduce them, because I took them out of my diet for around 9 to 10 months and then slowly reintroduced.
And then slowly reintroduced
yes.
it. And you did you find it beneficial when you reintroduced it back
yes.
into your system?
But it was very interesting, because if I would blend them in
yeah.
and make like a smoothie, I would be fine. But if I would make an oatmeal with either milk or water, usually almond milk or almond and coconut milk, and put a little bit of maybe Greek yogurt or some kind of fruit or some kind of berries and some honey. If I would cook oats, like if they would expand,
yeah,
they
yeah.
would make me feel bloated. But if they were blended,
yeah.
or if I made pancakes, again, blend everything in a blender and just make some pancakes or waffles, that would be fine. That wouldn't irritate me.
Maybe it may have had some effect. The cooking effect might have had some change to the oat. Because one of the things that people say about gluten, which is contained in a lot of food products, and they go through a gluten elimination diet and they feel better. Humans aren't designed to digest gluten. So if you eliminate gluten in your diet, you will feel better and you'll feel a lot less bloated and all that. But gluten is a very important ingredient as well. It serves a function, and it's important because it's also food without gluten tastes a little bit more bland. And most people say, well, it's more difficult to tolerate a gluten-free diet long term unless you had a real reason to eliminate it, which is important in patients with celiac disease. They have to eliminate gluten completely. So the gluten ingredient, removing it by certain methods when you manufacture it, helps how you tolerate the food. And similarly, I think the way you cook foods can eliminate certain elements within it, which helps your digestive system. And each one is individually different. Now, somebody might have a real bad effect where they have, for instance, raw pepper. Green pepper might cause really nasty effects, but if it's cooked, then the same person will have it absolutely fine. And it's an element of how the food that you take in is reacting to both the gut microbiome in your case and also the lining, and a lot of things goes on with the food. So it's very difficult to say. And what you have effectively proven is that you have to really keep a diary of how you're eating certain foods and work through that, because the same ingredient done in a different way is seen by the body in a different light. A raw vegetable compared to a cooked vegetable, it has a different feel, different way it's going through your system. So it's about, once you've eliminated certain things where you feel there is a culprit food, eliminate it and just really monitor how you are taking it.
Speaking of oats,
yeah.
One of my clients asked me about Soaking oats and rice overnight, if this in something like ACV, really that critical for gut health? It's not always practical, that's all. Mm. And what types of carbs are kindest on the gut? Because usually sourdough bread is something that a lot of people find very easy to digest, but then maybe some other forms of bread are not as easy to digest. But what do you think about soaking oats and rice overnight?
The reason a lot of these whole grains, which is what it is, contained something called phytic acid, which is an ingredient which is really helpful in eliminating stuff, toxins from your system, but also they bind nutrients and are not don't allow your digestive system to absorb it into your system. So there's some people advocate, well, you could just leave some of whole grains that you have overnight in acid water. You could do it just with lemon. You don't need apple vinegar cider to eliminate some of these ingredients within the grain, which then allows your body to digest it more easily and helps also digest some of the nutrients. So that's the aim of soaking certain whole grains in acidic water overnight and then eating it. Is it something that I tell people about it? If people ask me, yes, but generally I wouldn't, because it takes them some effort to do it when they've already approached, when I'm already telling them about a variety of different things. It is done and it's been shown some people benefit from it, certainly. So, and if people are particularly troubled by bloating and having difficulty with certain ingredients, which are very important for their diet, oats, for instance, are very good. I would be, and maize and things like that, I would be suggesting as an option, trial it. Again, it's about trialing what works for them. So that's the reason they do the soaking in apple vinegar cider. You asked about sourdough bread as well, wasn't it? Sourdough bread is interesting because the way it's baked eliminates a lot of the, for instance, it has lower gluten content and it has a better digestibility in people. So people tolerate it better, it tastes nice. So those are the elements which make it quite popular, actually, increasingly popular, partly because of taste and also digestibility in people. It has the way it's cooked and baked, it has the fiber elements are in some ways easy, more broken down. So therefore your body, when it meets it, it allows it to digest it much more easily compared to, for instance, whole grain bread made or brown bread, for instance. So people like it.
Perfect. It's good to know. A lot to learn when it comes to gut health. And I really wanted to talk about the effects on our mental health and serotonin. And this is something that I didn't know up until a few years ago. And I think that this is something that maybe a lot of people are not aware of, how much of an impact it has on our gut health, has on our mental health. Can you talk a little bit more about the connection between the two?
Of course, of course. Now, as you mentioned, serotonin is an important what we call a neurotransmitter. It's a chemical which is very important in the brain, which helps the person feel good, feel better. And a lot of it is produced in the GI tract. So that in itself tells you that there's some issues. If there's any problems in your gut and you have less of this being produced, you're going to have a different experience. But let me tell you another interesting fact not many people realize is the most powerful and the strongest nerve connection is between the brain and the gut through the vagus nerve. And that's the most powerful and it's the biggest nerve, actually. And part of the reason is that a lot of what's going on in the brain is transmitted through the vagus nerve right down the spine into your intestine. And a lot of people experience it. I'm sure heard of people who've had stress ulcers in their stomach because they've gone through, they've been so stressed. Because when you have a lot of stress going on in your brain, it's transmitting a lot of neurotransmitters through your spine encouraging your stomach to produce a lot more acid. You produce a lot more acid, you have a higher risk of ulcers. So direct correlation. And little do people know that before the days when we had Nexium or Omeprazole, all these anti-acid medicines, do you know what was the treatment for people who had ulcers in the stomach?
No.
It was physically, surgeons would cut the vagus nerve to the stomach.
That was
the treatment. That was essentially, so essentially it shows you there's a connection between the brain and your gut. And the only way to stop the acid production in these patients was you had to cut the vagus nerve. But thankfully, we don't need to do that. We have medicines, but it's even better. There are ways of calming your vagus nerve, which are very important. And if you follow directions on that, you have a way of actually improving the connection between your brain and your gut. And it's very important to do that. The other way people have this connection that they know about between the brain and the gut is during times when there are a lot of when there's anxiety, stress, there's a need, there's a lot of transmission of nerves from the brain down to your intestine, and you feel like you have to rush to the toilet. It's a very common one, and it's called exam nerves, that feeling that you have to go to the toilet. And that's quite common. The amount of how strongly you experience it depends on every individual, how well ingrained that cycle is. Some people experience it at the touch of anxiety. Some people need a bit of actual exams, and then they really do experience it. But then again, there are ways of modulating that response, and it's very important to understand that is what's causing that feeling of urgency and having to rush the toilet. And that's all also normal, but yet can become abnormal, and therefore we need to learn ways of calming that down. That's very important. So those are things I focus on when I see patients expressing those sorts of symptoms, because some people could concentrate on using medicines to calm things down and that, but there are ways, tools you can use to actually do that without resorting to medications, and it's better to keep it natural.
Always. Every time when we were kids, we would always just get bombarded with antibiotics. And my mom was
antibiotics. And my goodness, do they wipe out the good bacteria?
Everything.
Most people,
everything. Yeah. Yes, and most absolutely. People don't know.
I think antibiotics are very effective. When you need them, you have to take them. But most people who take antibiotics, for instance, for chest patients, will recognize that it upsets their tummy, because it's fundamentally taking away a lot of your gut microbiome for a while. Therefore, you have to, after you had a period of antibiotics, really replenish it through either utilizing the combination of prebiotics and probiotics in food terms, so all the fiber-rich foods along with your fermented foods. Really push that after a period of antibiotics.
So what usually causes, I say this wrong, gut dysbiosis?
The dysbiosis.
Yes.
A combination of things can cause... What gut dysbiosis basically means is there's a change in the populations of the bacteria. The good bacteria may have become reduced and the bad bacteria have overtaken. And when the bad bacteria overtake, the kind of products that they produce are far inferior. The good products have gone down and the bad products come up. So and it's all disordered. So when you eat foods and you meet a disordered gut microbiome, the way you digest things might be altered, make you feel different, make you feel uncomfortable. And again, the things that are pouring out of your GI tract going up to your brain will be a bit different. So you feel different. So that's where you feel where there's a lot of gut dysbiosis going on. And we know that that is the case in patients, for instance, with inflammatory bowel disease, and patients with inflammatory bowel disease such as ulcerative colitis or Crohn's. If you compare the gut microbiome in that group of patients with somebody without Crohn's or ulcerative colitis, there's a vast difference in the gut microbiome now. And it's about adjusting the diet and making that gut microbiome much stronger. And that's where the research is at the moment, really focused on in trying to see how we manipulate things to make it stronger, better, and how it has an impact on the disease. Now, going back to talking about dysbiosis, the most common causes of dysbiosis, I would say, there's three. Number one is clearly GI infections can cause it. So if you have a nasty bug goes into your system, this just causes an upset to the equilibrium, the balance of your gut microbiome. The other things like antibiotic, very, very important cause. And a third one, which most people don't recognize, is stress. Stress goes down. The nerves, again, transmit hormones, not just make your bowels work vigorously or produce acid. They produce lots of chemicals that really will affect your good bacteria. So periods of stress will alter your gut microbiome in subtle ways that affect you. So altogether, you have that, you have dysbiosis, and then when you then have foods, it's not a surprise you will feel a little bit more troubled by any dysbiosis that might be there. So it's now about balancing that out. That's where I try and utilize the gut microbiome test that we have access to try and show people what might be the imbalance and try and effect any change for the better.
It is so incredible how far and how advanced medicine is these days. If you were to compare to 20 years ago, 30, 40, 50 years ago,
it's incredible. And the technology is really advancing. So I can now individualize advice I give in terms of diet to that individual, knowing what their gut microbiome looks like.
Incredible. So one of my clients asked about protein and IBS. Dairy and protein powders make my issues worse. They cause bloating and other issues. Can we discuss about this? And if there are any supplements that you would recommend for bloating, constipation, IBS, and which ones are overhyped? Now, I don't really ever mention any brand names online or publicly. So we don't have to talk.
No,
we don't have to name names.
In general
terms, but in general,
I think protein powders often have ingredients which will cause bloating. The number of people that know who put up with it. A lot of people know when they've taken protein powders, they experience a bit of bloating, and it's just comes with the territory of wanting to have very high concentrated proteins. Dairy products, again, if you are a little bit more lactose intolerant, dairy products go into your intestine and are not easily digested by yourself. So the bacteria get to have a party, produce a lot of gas, and then cause lots of issues. But it's then about identifying if those ingredients are there. You go with milk, dairy products that might have lower lactose. For instance, you might want kefir as a probiotic-rich food instead of yogurt. So protein shakes and that have less of an effect, but the powders, which are very concentrated and have ingredients in them, I see that quite a lot. So yes, that's definitely there. I think you asked a little bit about what are the more gentler forms of carbohydrates, that one question, which I haven't answered. I think the more bland carbohydrates, like potatoes, is very, very, very bland and much better tolerated. Plain rice is also a good starch component that people tolerate, some people, and pasta. Some people like it, some people don't, but it's very bland and most people can tolerate it.
I find that anything rice-based I can digest very, very, very easily. But then some things that are oats-based, sometimes they make me feel a little bit...
Wheat-based is the hardest.
Yes. And whey protein, I have not had that in many, many, many years. And also dairy products. It is very interesting. I've had a very interesting gut journey, because some things would really make me bloated and give me skin breakouts and things like that. And then as soon as I took them out of my diet...
Right.
It was fine. And it was mostly...
See that relation with food and going all the way to skin breakups and all that? And we do know that the gut microbiome, elements of it, get into your system. Don't forget, you've got 40 trillion bacteria in there. And if you think the 40 trillion bacteria just want to stay in the intestine and don't want to get into your bloodstream, well, it's definitely getting into your bloodstream. Therefore, it's what people don't realize is 70% of your immune system is all in your intestine. 70%. So only 30% is roaming around your heart, your lungs, your brain, everywhere else. 70% is there trying to keep everything in place. So a big element of your gut microbiome will get out and get into your system, products, and not just chemicals, but actually fragments of these bacteria do get in. And that's where the immune system tries to capture it. But some of these get into your system, we do know. And what we're now trying to work out is, do those elements that break into your system, into your bloodstream, and seep elsewhere, are they the culprit that might be the triggers of certain skin issues, of certain autoimmune conditions? So this is where the research is going. Is it an element of that getting into your system, triggering some response elsewhere where they shouldn't be, but somehow managing it? So therefore, keeping your gut microbiome healthy, strong, and keeping your lining of your gut strong, very important. We're getting much more good signals that if you have that as being very strong, the rest of you is strong.
It is so connected. I remember when I was younger, I had a very slow bowel movement, and sometimes I would get bloated, but I didn't know any different and I didn't know any better. So I used to think that that's just how my life is going to look like until the rest of my life. You know, I will go to the toilet maybe once, maybe twice per week, and I would always feel bloated. But then when I started educating myself a little bit more about it, and like reading different books and just listening to different people's podcasts and talking to different doctors and doing a couple of courses about gut health and nutrition myself. And then when I implemented everything that I've learned, I was like, oh, okay, so this is how it feels like having a normal bowel movement and not feeling in pain and bloated and constipated. And then that made me even more passionate about like raising awareness, I guess, about this, because I have been through ups and downs.
See, you see, the quality of life is so much better if you have a proper gut which is working for your benefit. You don't even notice it then. That's how it should be. And that's my aim is to make sure somebody comes to me with those problems actually gets to a point where actually you're not thinking about the gut. And the same in patients who may have Crohn's or ulcerative colitis or something more serious, same thing. They should be of the same quality of life where you're going to work, coming back, enjoying your daily activities of living without worrying or fussing about the gut. That's the point we should be aiming for. And it's not something that is impossible. Of course it's not. It's about identifying things, getting there, a little journey to take, but I think most people should get there. That's the aim.
100. If I can do it.
Yes.
Anyone can do it. One of the questions was about if someone has a fat liver, does the protein powder, like, is the protein powder good or bad for the liver? If you would recommend a natural source of protein, and what type of food? Fish, chicken, lamb. I always say, this is just my two cents, whole foods is the best kind of diet. But people nowadays look at you weirdly. They think that you have problems with food if you only eat whole foods. Eating healthy is not considered normal these days.
Oh.
But
fatty liver particularly, it's more associated with the fats you're eating and the fact that a lot of it is being stored in the liver. Protein per se shouldn't really be off. If you're provided you're taking good healthy protein, either from a fish source, egg, or it can be from any source really, which is ideally not processed. So lean chops of meat, that sort of thing. I think if you focus on that, that's fine. But if you're talking about liver and fatty liver, which is a very, very common problem, unfortunately, it's growing because of the obesity epidemic we have. If you have storage of fat in the liver in a small proportion of patients, it actually causes irritation in the liver. It's not good, and it causes damage to the liver. So trying to reduce your weight and doing exercise is the best way to do it. And But we're also identifying again in this is the gut microbiome element, where certain ingredients coming in from the gut, if you have a dysbiotic gut microbiome, irritates the liver as well, contributes to more of the fatty liver. So again, going back to your first position, if you have a strong, healthy gut producing the right ingredients, it's very protective against fatty liver. So that focusing on reducing fat and improving the prebiotic and probiotic input to your gut would be the answers. And that's my approach for fatty liver.
One other thing that I wanted to talk to you about, that I wanted to ask you, is about fiber. So we have soluble and insoluble. What are the difference between the two, and what food sources are?
Soluble and insoluble, basically soluble fiber is one that absorbs water and expands, and it's much more gentle on the body. Roughage fiber, which the best example of insoluble fiber is, for instance, the skin of tomato, skin of potato. It's not soluble, it doesn't dissolve, whereas the ingredient, the potato itself, has got a lot of soluble fiber within it. So you see the difference between the two. You need a combination of both, because the roughage, which is more insoluble fiber, the outer lining, it forms the ingredient of stool, which allows your body to for the intestine to work on your bowels. Because without that, you have less fiber getting into your intestine. The soluble fiber is very important ingredient, because a lot of that also gets into your intestine, and it's the magic, which is what is needed for your gut microbiome. That is what's feeding your gut microbiome, helping it grow and produce some of the chemicals I mentioned. So therefore, you need that element for your for a healthy gut, combination of both insoluble fiber and soluble fiber. The soluble fiber is much better digestible. Most people tolerate it better. Oat, for instance, has a higher element of soluble fiber, so it's better tolerated.
That is interesting. Would you recommend someone to take, I know there are quite a lot of, again, fiber supplements?
If they're clearly not able to take it from green vegetables and fruits, from the natural source, yes, I have given prescriptions of that to my patients, because I feel that they're just not going to be able to get it from their diet. Their diet is fairly restrictive, and so they need that supplement. Because, and the way I give it, I give supplements of the ones which are as natural as possible, which they take and stays within their gut and does not in any way stimulate the gut. So your own gut is working itself. So you're basically taking a fiber product which is replacing some of the green vegetables you might take. Not as good as the actual ingredient, but actually does a good job and has the effect that I wish to see in my patients.
The final question that I wanted to ask you is, if we will take imaginary example myself, if I came to you and I said that I really struggle with bloating, constipation, yeah, but I don't know what is the main cause, I'm feeling hopeless, helpless, yeah, what would you suggest me to do first? Like, where would I start?
Well, I would definitely start with talking to you about the story of when it started, how it started. I would try and identify if there are any elements that worried me about certain things that might be actually causing this in the bloodstream, in the medicines you might be taking, in the GI tract itself. Were there any conditions? I would first want to make sure that there was no actual gastroenterology problem that's contributing to your symptoms, because without taking care of that, any amount of dietary changes is not going to really have a long-lasting effect, and in fact may be harmful by masking the underlying problem. So that's very important. Once I've done that, I would approach you in the sense that I would make sure that the bowels are functioning either through a combination of diet or a fiber-rich supplement that I would give you. And I might add in probiotics as well, specific ones which are helpful for bloating that I use, and I have got research based behind it. So that's my approach. That would be the first step. Then I would monitor your response. How are you doing? Do we need to go through a little bit of an elimination diet? I would make sure you have a little food diary to come back to me with, and then we work through that. But ultimately, I would expect you to improve. I would make sure that you go through a journey, but the ultimate goal of which is to make sure your bowels are moving well and you're not experiencing bloating and you're having a fantastic quality of life.
It's what we all deserve.
Yes, absolutely. And you're doing a good job trying to get everyone to do
to go to the toilet.
Yes, and it's very important. It's got to be.
It is.
Not many people talk about it, but it's a very important part of life.
It's such a taboo topic, and I feel like a lot of people are very ashamed to say these things out loud, or to even maybe they're not self-aware, or maybe they think, like me, when I was 12, 15, 16 years old, I had no idea. I just thought that was normal, because I remember I went to Spain for 7 days and I did not go to the toilet for those 7 days. And then when I was reading a book, I think that the book was called Gut. It said something, I can't remember the exact name, but it did say, like, your body knows your toilet. So my toilet was mine at home. So when I changed my environment, I don't know if it was like a mental block or something, but I could not sit down and go to the toilet and relax and do the business. It was horrible for a whole week.
That's quite a dramatic story of and how it would have affected you is only something I can imagine. It's just very difficult. And I mean, my son calls me the poo doctor, which is quite right, because I always ask about poo. And it's very important, because I keep it open, because if the poo is working well, you know, the GI tract, the whole gut system is working well. So I get the answer. If he says, oh, my stomach's hurting, I specifically ask, how's the poo doing, and all of that. So that tells me a lot about how the GI tract is organized. And it's very important, because if that isn't functioning well, then I think it leads to other issues going on, and it affects the person a lot. And unless they mention it, you can't solve it. So I always make it a point of talking about it and making it a very normal conversation.
It should be normalized.
Yeah.
It should be normalized. People should talk more openly and freely about gut health. So for the people who don't know you, where can they find you? Where are you based?
I'm based at Mubadala Health, which is a clinic in Jumeirah, in center of Dubai. And they can always look online. They'll find us there, and we're open 6 days a week. Apart from Saturday, we're open every other day, and they can always make queries, and I think you'll have links for our email and our website.
Yes. I'll put the link to your website in the description down below. And I just want to say thank you so much for coming today, and I appreciate your time and talking about all things gut health. I could talk about this for another 10 hours for sure. I feel
absolutely. Like, I love talking about the gut microbiome and understanding of it and explaining it to patients and telling them about it. So if anyone wants to find out more about the gut microbiome and ways of improving it, optimizing things, and about their gut health in relation to any GI conditions, then feel free to reach out, and I'll be there to answer any questions.
Thank you so much. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you to everyone who has listened to this. I will see you. We will see you in the next episode. Hope that you guys have a great rest of your day. And until next time, I will see you and hear you next time.